afternoon, everyone, and thank you for being with us. I have the privilege of introducing our presenter, Dr. Heather Schwartz. She's the Program Director of Pre-K-12 Educational Systems in RAND's Education and Labor Division and is also a senior policy researcher. She was the lead author on the most recent recommended practices guide from the RAND Summer Learning Series, sponsored by the Wallace Foundation, and we appreciate her being here today. Thank you, Dr. Schwartz, and I'll turn it over to you.
I just unmuted myself. Hello, all. Thank you for joining us, especially during such a stressful and busy time. I just hats off to you for the burden that you're carrying. I don't know about you, but those first 3 weeks when school after school was closed was really rough, and it did level out for me, but for you all, I'm sure as you're facing the end of the school year, you're probably in another peak of activity. So thank you for joining. And today I'm going to be describing our research about a summer program that was delivered face-to-face, but I know that a lot of you are probably contemplating doing a remote summer learning program this summer, so I have some questions for you about that, and I'm hoping to be able to adapt the talk to at least talk about remote learning a little bit. So please do put in questions that you have. So with that, let's go to the next slide. And here I wanted to just start by getting a sense from you with this poll. Are you going to offer summer school in summer 2020? So if you can answer that, and then we'll spend a few minutes discussing. Yes, I sure do. So I see that the majority of you, about a little over half, who took the poll are debating, or you don't know. Yes, that seems to be what we're hearing too. 21% of you, which is just three, know already that you're not going to do it. Some doing remote, and one of you doing an in-person summer program. So, okay, well, don't know, debating. Hopefully I have something that's relevant to you as you consider it, and I'd love to please do pepper me with questions as we go through if you have questions about how what I'm talking about relates to you and your program. Okay, next slide. So I'm going to tell you about recommendations that we made from a particular summer program that we at RAND studied over 6 years. And it is one among 43 summer programs that this 2019 review, which RAND also did, but is separate from the study I'm telling you about today. In that 2019 review, there was a scan of summer programs and the research about them, identifying 43 in total that met the top three evidence tiers for ESSA. And just as a reminder for yourself, I pasted the evidence tiers here. Based on that 2019 review of summer programs that I just mentioned, this review found that those promoting SEL, which I know is of particular interest right now during COVID-19, those promoting SEL were effective. So just for as an example, the program called Just Do It, targeted at students with learning disabilities, led to positive impacts on students' self-esteem, their depression, and adaptability. But in most of the cases, these summer programs, including the one that I'm going to describe today, don't improve student achievement across the board. So for example, with Elevate Math summer program, they saw increases in student performance in algebra, but not in these other areas that you see listed at the bottom of the slide. So now we get to the program that we studied that I'm going to talk about today. This study met the ESSA criteria for Tier 1 evidence, and it's called the National Summer Learning Project, or NSLP. And like I say, this is what I'm going to talk about for the rest of my time here. Next slide. So it's the Wallace Foundation that launched and sponsored NSLP, and they did so in 2011. The reason they did it is they wanted to expand summer opportunities for low-income students in urban settings. And they, so Wallace also hired us at RAND to understand whether and how these district-led, voluntary, not remedial or mandatory summer learning programs that included both academic and enrichment opportunities, whether and how they improved student outcomes. So the foundation worked with five school districts and their community partners that you see on the map here, Boston, Dallas, Duval, Pittsburgh, and Rochester. And to date, The study that we did is the largest and the most definitive of the summer learning program research. Each of the five districts offered summer programs that shared these characteristics that you see on the slide. So all of them were voluntary. None of them were mandated for a student to progress to the next grade level. All were free, and they were offered by a school district with a local partner, like an intermediary or community-based organization. All of them included breakfast, lunch, and snack and transportation. They were at least 5 to 6 weeks with the small classes and at least 3 hours of academics per day, led by certified teachers, plus daily enrichment. Each of these five cities served at least 200 rising fourth grade students. But, Anna, if you can go back one slide. They also varied. In some of the cases, the school districts were solely the ones who delivered the programs, and others it was very 50-50, and like Boston After School and Beyond and Boston Public School very jointly managed and led the activities. And the number of sites, in some places there were very few schools, like as few as one, even one large school that housed several programs, to as many as 10 summer sites or summer schools spread throughout the city. And each city or district selected their own curricula. So there was not a unified math, ELA, or other subject area curricula across these cities. Looks like there's a little bit of a lag on the slide moving here. So this list shows you the trove of data that we collected over the years. In short, we conducted thousands of observations of summer programs. I spent several summers watching summer programs, which is really fun and interesting, as well as many surveys and interviews. So in a nutshell, we found that districts and their partners can carry out high-quality, voluntary summer learning programs that serve a large number of children. And most critically, it was the students who consistently attended. That's the big crux that I'm going to talk to you about, which we defined as 20 or more days out of a 25 to 30-day program. It was those students who consistently attended who reaped the benefits. So we published a series on the Summer Learning Project, and it's the fifth publication with the red circle around it that I'm going to talk to you about. This is the final publication we did where we pulled together in one place all of our recommendations for primarily for superintendents, for leaders of the after-school programs, and for school leaders like yourselves about how to plan and operate the summer programs. This is the publication that I'm going to be going through today. To boil it down to its essence, we found that four factors made voluntary summer programs effective. First is whether they lasted long enough. I'm going to talk about each of these. Second was students regularly attending. Third was quality instruction, because we saw highly, highly varied instruction. Third, and then fourth, positive climate. As a consequence, we organized the report to provide detailed recommendations on these eight categories that you see on this slide. So in all, we have about 60 recommendations in our report. I'm going to cover four of the eight categories that I just showed you today. The first is turning to early planning, which might seem like a laugh right now, considering our COVID-19 crises. I mean, who has time to plan? We weren't given the luxury of planning. But the bottom line was that we found that planning was a huge differentiator across the districts about the quality of the summer programming that they offered. Cities where they had very little planning devoted reaped the benefits, reaped the costs in the sense of buses not showing up on time, materials not being in the classes on time, staff not having been trained ahead of time. There's a lot of bumpiness, especially in those first weeks of the summer program, when cities that did not invest in early planning. So in short, we saw that planning influenced virtually every single aspect of the operation of a program. Next slide. So I realize that these recommendations do not exactly align with the realities today, but we were, I don't see the next slide up yet. Do you? I'll wait for it so that you're right. Here we are. We recommended that schools start their planning actively by January if they're going to be hosting summer in say, June, July, August. Obviously, that's not going to be happening right now. We also recommended a dedicated lead person, like a program director or a manager, given half-time or more coverage to lead the planning. We saw that as a big differentiator across the cities. And to be regular and comprehensive in scope, thinking about busing, transportation, meals, instruction, enrichment activities, engagement with parents. Those cities that did do those things with regularity prior to the summer launch had more successful programs. Moving on to teacher selection. So this was another big differentiator. Those programs that hired teachers, now remember, all districts were hiring certified teachers to teach the academic content, and all of them were offering academic content for 3 or more hours of the day. But not all of them hired certified teachers who are matched to grade level and subject matter experience. And those that did, we saw much higher instructional quality in the classroom. So that was a recommendation. And we also saw differences in staff's influence on site climate. Some were really invested and cheerleaders for the program and contributed, again, these are in-person programs, really contributed to the feeling of like we're in it together, we're a team. This site is about X. We are about kindness. We are about caring for each other. We are about responsible citizenship. And other teachers had much more of a dialing it in and didn't have that same kind of enthusiasm for the program. So these two aspects of teachers' skill set were we thought rose to the top. We also thought that cities, districts and schools recruited teachers differently. And we saw that those who advertised saying, in essence, what's in it for you, you teachers, to work in this program and emphasizing the benefits to teachers, not just the altruistic importance of summer programming for students, that helped attract more applications. These were the sub-bulleted lists you hear, like access to new curricular materials, small class sizes, half-day schedules. These are the types of benefits that the cities were offering in their recruiting materials for teachers. Now, this is not probably top of mind during the COVID emergency, where the goal is just to get something up and running. But in terms of retention, we also found that the majority of teachers in this study did reapply in subsequent summers, and that they said that these things were really important to them. Being able to work half the day, not full day, having materials that they needed on time instead of having to wing it and bring in their own materials or create their own lesson plans. And having enough staff at the campus to address students' needs and behavior. Next slide. Yep. Okay, now we're going to turn to the topic of use of time. This is my particular favorite category. Okay, so this was really, I would say, of all the dimensions on which programs varied, to me, use of time was probably the largest. And why is it so critical? Because summer programs are relatively short. Let's say it's a 5-week program. You're already losing time in that week one to get ramped up, figure out what you're doing. And then by week 5, you're ramping down with the end of summer programming. So really, we're talking about 3 weeks of your golden time to actually cover content. And we found that productive learning time, not just logged number of instructional minutes, but logged number of productive instructional minutes, was more predictive of student achievement. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. So it really varied, but summer programs lost as much as a quarter of their intended instructional minutes. And why? Lots of late classes, lots of early dismissals, lots of long breaks during class. Transition times were real issues, where the master schedule didn't realistically account for the time it took for students to go from room A to room B, which meant really it was sending an implicit message that it was okay for classes to run off schedule because there was no way for them to actually realistically run on schedule. So classes would routinely start 10, 15 minutes late because kids were filtering in. And so it just sort of undermined the sense that the academic press or the importance of those instructional minutes. And then finally, poor student attendance, and which is I'm going to discuss in subsequent slides. All those in combination reduced instructional minutes. So what did the schools do where they maximized instructional time? First of all, they lasted at least 5 weeks long because of, like I say, the lost or fixed lost time of ramping up and then the ramping down. They scheduled 3 to 4 hours a day for academics, and they didn't break up academics into multiple chunks. So, for example, some summer programs would have half of a math class before lunch, and then they break for lunch, then they come back, have the rest of the math class. In those types of structures of classes, we saw more wasted instructional minutes because essentially there was two startups to the lesson, two wind downs to the lesson, and it kids' attention, especially in that second period, was lower, and it was just a less tight class. The places who also maximized instructional time, they had built a bell schedule that actually made sense and where people could be where they were supposed to be at the time they were intended to be. And then finally, they also communicated some kind of press. So I saw one summer program, it happened to be in Boston, and it was, I think their phrasing was on time and on task was one of their mantras at the summer program. So here I wanted to ask a poll question about you all. Now, I think more than half of you said you were not yet sure if you're offering a summer program. For those who are, whether it's remote or hybrid or in person, if you could answer this question. I'd be very curious for those who are debating what you're thinking, what kind of duration you're considering. Okay, 4 to 5 weeks and some view 2 to 3 weeks. Well, so as I've alluded to before, especially with these shorter programs, 2 to 3 weeks, I think the challenge will be, now again, if it's a remote program, it's a whole different ball of wax because you're not dealing with learning that buses didn't actually go on the route they were supposed to go on, and that the books didn't arrive at site X when they were supposed to. But nevertheless, there still is that sort of startup and wind down process, even in remote programs. And I think the challenge there will be to do those efficiently so that they don't soak up, you know, as much as a week, which is what we saw in a number of these summer programs.
And Connie added something in the chat box that says 4 weeks with only 3 days a week for 2 hours.
Oh, interesting. Connie, is that going to be for K through what grade levels? That's interesting. Has the staggering that we're hearing, reading about in different countries, it's very interesting. It'll be, and now I think about it, summer programming might be a good way to start to get your feet wet in hybrid programming, or this idea of kids coming for shorter periods of time for face-to-face instruction. That's very interesting. If we have time for discussion at the end, I'd love to hear from you all on what you're thinking. Yeah. On time and on task. I know, I love that too. I was all over that on time, on task message. Alrighty. So I'm going to take us back, and hopefully we'll have some open time at the end for discussion. Okay, so fourth and last category that I'm going to cover today, student recruitment. All right, why is this important? First bullet, obviously. They're not going to benefit academically, socially, if they don't attend, if they don't attend regularly. Second, it's expensive to host these. It's basically running a mini school year. It's not worth the investment if kids don't benefit. And third, it might mean, now this is thinking about, this bullet really relates to people, districts who are thinking about summer programming year on year, but you can't retain a steady staff over time if kids are not attending at the rate that they need to support that staff. We did see challenges in this area. So even with quite a bit of effort and resources thrown at this subject, it was still the case that 20 to 30%, depending on the city, of the students who had signed up for the program never actually showed up. And then those who did show up, so those who did attend one or more days in a summer program, the average student attended three quarters of the days. So that means that in a 5-week program, they're coming to 4 weeks out of the 5 weeks in total. And then this was in this summer program that was that we studied. It was two consecutive years. So in other words, we were offering it to students to come at the end of third grade and then at the end of fourth grade. And those who, they signed up for both years, but in fact, actually half of those who came in the first year returned in the second year. So there was quite a bit of turnover among students. Okay, next slide. So what were the promising practices where we saw better student attendance? First was people who had spent time thinking about the recruitment materials, not just a single email blast or a single robocall, but an actual attempt to display what the school summer program was about and to brand it, so to speak. You know, this is a program that's about outdoor adventures. This is a program that's about developing citizenship. This is a STEM program. Whatever it is, having some kind of identity for it and very clear information about when does it start, when does it end, what are the hours in the day, what is the attendance expectations, which were often never clearly communicated. So a lot of parents signed up thinking of it as optional, and if they went on vacation, so be it, no problem. So the having that clear and accurate information helped. Second was to, at the beginning of the outset of the program, if you have 100 people who are signing up, anticipate that 80 of them are actually going to show up. That was, I'm using a rough rule of thumb there. So basically staffing towards the 80 instead of staffing towards the 100. Providing incentives for those students who attend. So Friday raffles based on that week's attendance was a very common type of incentive, seemed to be extremely popular among students, elementary age students, that is. And then finally, places that had positive site climate had better student attendance. So the places that felt really warm and welcoming and, you know, less anonymous were places where students were returning the most. Okay, next slide. And actually, my gosh, we went so much faster than I thought. So I have a discussion question here. We have plenty of time on this, and then I'm going to point you to where you can find these reports, and then we have some time for discussion. So first one is student attendance, especially tricky with remote learning. How do you intend to take attendance in your summer program? Let's start there. This is not a poll. This is just a type in the chat box.
And be sure when you type it in the chat box, include all panelists and attendees so that we can all see your comment. Danielle writes, our program offers daily incentives and our students get a $100 gift card for attending all days.
That's among the more generous that we saw. That would be great. I think that would be an effective incentive.
Feel free to use the chat box to type in what you do. Danielle follows up and says, for daily prizes, we have all names in a bucket and we draw out 15 to 20 students each day to pick a variety of prizes. Kathleen writes, student information system is used for attendance. The incentive idea is a good one.
Especially for those of you thinking of remote learning, I heard really that schools are very struggling to take attendance. Does attendance mean that you, student, have logged on to a single point in the day to, let's say, a Zoom synchronous meeting, like a morning meeting? Is that attendance for the day? Is it students uploading their work to an LMS at the end of the day, at the end of a Friday? Is that attendance for the whole week? I think that I've not heard consensus forming on how to measure a student's attendance in this all remote format. I'm curious if any of you have landed on a working system to measure students' attendance.
Well,
I'll wait for another.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll wait for another minute on the chat box, and if the answer is no, then vote.
Oh, yeah, we have a few. Connie,
yeah.
I love the incentives. We never did this. We just keep attendance or just document who attended our Zoom sessions. That's interesting. And then Kathleen writes, any check-in with a teacher is considered attendance. Some elementary teachers require a morning meeting and take attendance after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so on the subject of incentives, that I'll just share other things. That cash incentive is certainly a large one. There's other incentives I heard were students who, this was in Duval County, students who attended, I think, 4 out of every 5 days over each week of the summer program got to go to, is it Disney World or Disneyland that's in Florida? I always mix those up. Okay, so Disney it is, Disney World. So those kids, only the high attenders basically got to go to Disney World. So like a large field trip option. I have daily raffles, popsicles. I mean, you know, it could be lower cost treats, stickers, those kinds of things as raffles. For high attendance in that week.
I don't know if you saw Peter's comment through Google Forms within Google Classroom for remote learning K-12.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of attendance.
Okay, well, let's move so that, because I'm keen to make sure that you get to ask your questions if you have any. So I'll just point you to where this information sits. So looking at that slide, we're back at the cover of the report I told you about, where we have all of our recommendations. That's also wonderfully Wallace-sponsored this online toolkit. And the toolkit has things like sample job descriptions, attendance-taking tools, policies, MOUs between schools, and CBOs to provide enrichment services. Policies about student discipline, things that you might want to consult yourself if you were wanting that you could pick up and adapt for your own program. So next slide shows you where you can find these. They're both free. They're both downloadable. Bottom line is you could Google this on Wallace's website or RAND, and I'll put my contact info on the next slide. And with that, that's my last slide. Here's my email address. You're welcome to email me. But I also wanted to throw this open and give at least 10 minutes, which we have more than that, to any questions about your own programs this summer or otherwise.
Okay. And while we're doing that, Heather, you had a few other slides. Do you want to go through them since we have a little bit of time?
Let's see. I had that poll question. I'm just looking through the back slides here. We could do this. Yeah, actually, this is because I'm personally curious. Could we do this poll question here that you're showing on the screen?
Sure. Uh-huh.
And even if,
So go ahead and feel free to answer that poll. For those of you running summer 2020 programs, which aspects of planning are complete? And it says select all that apply, but I have to say when I put this in, I only selected one. So.
Ah, okay.
Sorry. And as far as the question Peter asked, yes, the presentation slides and the recording will be available on the NAESP website. I'll put the link in there. Okay, a few more seconds and then we'll wrap that up. Okay, I'm going to end it and share the results. Can you see that?
Yep.
So 70%.
Yep. So. Yeah, this is our reality, right? It's barely know when our school year is ending or when the next one is starting.
70% said none. We haven't yet started or decided if we'll have one. And 10% said they're set to start and end dates and total program days, along with 10% for selected criteria and 10% for other.
And one hero said they've already selected the curricula. Hurrah, kudos. Kudos, and that actually segues over to a question that somebody asked in this chat box about effective instruction. We were defining effective instruction as on-task activities, and we had a whole coding scheme for observations about quality of questions and the content covered. But really to get at your question, we did the thing that was really important was the use of a written curriculum for the summer. We saw some programs that said, you know what, teachers, you're professionals, you go write your own lessons. Do it, fly your flag, have fun, go for it. And where that happened, it actually proved quite burdensome. And many teachers told us that they really didn't have time to make the lessons and that they were either never making the lessons and walking in with no lesson or writing a lesson last minute and essentially winging it. So we saw less content covered in that district that where they had adopted the write your own lessons, and the subsequent year they changed and dropped it and adopted a written curricula from off the shelf that they adapted, that the district then adapted. So whether it's the district writing curricula or whether purchasing a third party existing like commercially available curricula, it was important that there be a written set of lesson plans that followed a scope and sequence for teachers to follow. That really did help with the continuity of instruction and quality. I'll pause there if there's any other questions on that, about quality of instruction.
Kathleen writes, this lack of planning is due to a lack of guidance / recommendation from the state.
We do name in the, and I'd have to go back and look it up because it's not coming top of mind. We do name a summer curricula. So it's that we saw in use in several cities. So it's, you know, designed for 6 weeks of instruction, and I suppose that you would just have to limit the number of units if you're doing shorter than 6 weeks. Now, we heard from districts that they then needed to shorten them and that there was too much content to cover. But there are curricula out there expressly for summer programming that are aligned to Common Core standards and so forth.
Teresa asks, did schools do pre-teaching for the next year or remedial for academics? Were kids still grouped?
We saw a little bit of both, and actually we saw, you know, that recommendation about teachers who had grade level experience and content knowledge, which seemed so logical. Like, well, yeah, of course that would be ideal or better. But the reason, the grade experience especially, we saw really effective forms of teachers saying, remember how we ended in May, we were working on XXX math skills? We're going to practice some of that more. So there was a little bit of rehashing some of the spring things that got rushed before the state standardized testing. And then there was some pre-teaching. But I would say really it was like 80-20. 80% of time spent on cementing some of the core skills from the prior year and then towards the end, previewing and moving on to the next year. The kids were not skill grouped, mostly, I think, because they didn't have enough good information coming into the program, because these kids were coming in from different schools, feeder schools. So it's not as if the summer program lead knew all these students or had great records on all of these students. Had some records, but not complete. So they didn't do skill grouping, but they would do offering extensions. So, for instance, during independent learning time, we would see really skilled teachers handing out more work for those students who were already at the top of the class and could push more on, and also those teachers spending time. These were classes of 10 or fewer students. Those teachers circulating among all 10, but spending more time with the kids to reteach those kids who were struggling. Mm-hmm. But we did not see groupings of, like, tracking where there were 10 students who were all working on remedial instruction and 10 who were all, you know, working on advanced topics that were going to come up in the next year.
Another question came in. Were there any purchase curriculum programs that stand out for you as being quality programs for summer school
that you could recommend? I'm going to look it up. The thing that I'm not remembering, I think it's American Reading Company, but I have to look that up. I think that's the curriculum I was referring to. I don't know if that rings the bell for anyone else. Yeah, they do have a summer solutions. I think that's some. It's called summer semester. Yes. So I will write Reading Company summer semester. It had some high quality content. And the theme was, and that was, every student was making their own book. Mm-hmm. And they had to, over the course of the summer program, so they had to read and understand content and then write their own book about their own subject.
Heather, a question I had was, in all of your years' experience really researching this topic of summer learning, are there any recommended practices that you feel principals should be using in looking at a COVID situation of maybe a blended kind of summer learning?
We weren't looking at blended. So I don't have great examples for you of blended, but I do have something that caught my eye, which was Jimmy Kim has this program that sends books home with children during the summer called Reads, R-E-A-D-S, all caps, for summer learning. So this, I'll write this in. Reads for summer learning. Jimmy Kim is a professor at Harvard. He has co-developed this program, and it's for elementary age students, and it's really about pairing kids with leveled readers, with topics that interest them. So not just sending 10 books to Gracie and 10 books to Heather. It's the same 10 books, and who knows, maybe Heather's really into topics that are in these 10 books, or maybe she's not. It's instead pre-selecting, okay, Heather's really into these types of topics, and she's at level H, so we should be sending 10 books home that are a little bit at the easier end of H and stretching into I, and then having some touch points with Heather over the summer. So that is it lends itself to remote learning. It's always intended as 10 books being mailed home. So that is something that stands out to me as potentially a match, something that one could build off of if I was a school principal. And it's been well studied. He's done 10 randomized control trials on this program. So they've had time to iterate, make it a little better, tweak. Like, for instance, they learned the matching of books was really important, because at first they weren't matching books. And at first they weren't doing as great a job getting the leveled readers aligned to where kids were at. So that would be a relatively lower cost program to try in your own school.
Wonderful. Anything in the physical ed or math or anything, other areas that you can think of?
Physical ed. I'm wondering if there's any, no, short answer is no. I don't know of hybrid delivery programs or just remote, all remote summer programs for math and PE. It just, but I know that Boys and Girls Club and maybe Playworks have been trying to develop content that I would think would relate to physical activity for kids. But I don't, I'm sorry to say that I don't have any details on that. Is it, would it be helpful if I were to learn of resources if I sent you links and you could forward them to the participants?
Yes, that would be great. We did publish the resource that you gave us, and it's on the NAESP website at www.naesp.org. And yes, we'll be happy to add to that if you want to send us further information.
Okay, great.
Any other questions? I think I'll turn it back over to Gracie then to close us out.
Thank you, Dr. Schwartz, for being with us today. I really appreciate the emphasis that you've put on your research in helping to inform decisions on summer school. I think that's really, really important, and I know that principals are oftentimes drawn to that practical piece, but when we really look at our best practice, it's so important to make sure that we have a strong research foundation to base our best practices on, and that's what you've shared with us today. And I also have to say that I'm such a fan of the Wallace Foundation and the work that they do to look around and help support the best of what's going on out there. So just also want to say thank you to Wallace for sponsoring this study work and helping to bring this to our principals. So thank you again for being with us today.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming. I wish you the best of luck in the rest of the spring.